This episode of The H is brought to you in part by Human HQ. Human HQ is designed for folks who care about connecting over meaningful and open discussions about life, who desire to be an active part of a supportive community, and who seek to continuously improve and cultivate their best lives. It's a space for people who don't just talk about life, but do something about it, and want to surround themselves with others who do the same. Check out humanhq.org for more information, or follow them on Facebook and Instagram at HumanHQ. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Bronner, and this is Season 3, Episode 5, A Tastemaking Institution with Eric Sandler. In the spring of 2013, a dear friend with whom I shared a decade of history reached out to me on behalf of the small firm for which she worked as a graphic designer and invited me to become a writer for the new social media division of their company. She knew I loved to write and that I spent a fair portion of my time and sarcasm on Twitter saying ridiculous things that I've mostly, thankfully, since deleted. I jumped at the chance as their clientele was made up almost entirely of musical artists with far larger platforms than I would ever have on my own. There was something really fun about the idea of ghostwriting content that would be seen and engaged with by literal millions of people operating under the assumption that the artist in their headphones was also crafting the clever nonsense they were retweeting. But much like the songs those artists were most famous for singing, they had nothing to do with the writing. I was responsible for 2 tweets and 2 Facebook posts per day, per artist, delivered at the beginning of each week in the form of a most unimpressive Excel spreadsheet. And the entire job happened via email. Not one time did I ever actually meet or have a phone conversation with either my clients or even the account coordinators at the firm that hired me. The clients I work with change occasionally, but for the most part, it was that same process week in and week out. It didn't take long for the fun to fade away. It was handy side money, though, so I continued ghostwriting for 3.5 years, by the end of which, social media had lost virtually all of its appeal for me. Facebook became a necessary evil I only continued to inhabit for the sake of the podcast I was producing. Twitter became a mere vestige of virtual relationships I'd collected over the years but never tended. Instagram, on the other hand, still had a little shine for me. Although it occasionally served and still serves as fuel for my unfortunate habit of self-comparison, it also retained some of its creative charm. I could still go there and find some inspiration here and there. So when I started this show in the spring of 2017, Instagram was honestly the only social media channel that received any of my time or energy. And while I'm still not nearly as active there as I perhaps should be, the H's Instagram account has been a tremendous resource for me in deepening my love for this city and in connecting me with new people whose work I admire. One of the first folks to take notice of the H on Instagram in the very beginning of the show was a man I've since come to recognize as an institution in the Houston food scene. Eric Sandler.
My name is Eric Sandler. I'm the food editor for Culture Map.
Eric is a Houston native, the oldest of three, born in May of 1978, to Carl, a radiologist and professor of radiology at the UT Health Science Center, and Susan, a corporate attorney for Shell. He started his life living in the Memorial area, off Gessner. But in December of 84, when Eric was in first grade, he and his family relocated to Sugar Land.
At the time, like, Sugar Land was a really small town. I think the population was maybe less than 10,000 people, and we were in the old part of Sugar Land. So by that, I mean east of Highway 6 and north of Highway 90. So pretty near the sugar factory in a subdivision called Sugar Mill.
Not being a native Houstonian myself, despite literally being called Sugar Land, until this conversation, it had never dawned on me that there was any sort of connection between the Houston suburb and the sugar industry, let alone a connection that spanned nearly 200 years, as it was home to the Imperial Sugar Company.
The factory has closed, but, you know, when we were growing up, it was still very much open and you could take tours of it. And that was like one of the, you know, I think every elementary school in Fort Bend ISD probably took a tour of the sugar factory at some point.
As a kid, Eric was into all the typical 80s kid things. Train sets and action figures and Legos, etc., and eventually video games and, of course, TV.
Both my parents worked, so I remember watching probably a decent amount of TV and like early MTV. So like, you know, Madonna and Michael Jackson and Weird Al videos and all that stuff, you know, early 80s MTV is something I think about from that time in my life, and Star Wars movies.
Another pretty significant part of Eric's childhood was his family's Jewish faith, something that wasn't nearly as common in Sugar Land as it had been in the Memorial area.
If we weren't in actuality the only Jewish family in the entire elementary school, like, it certainly felt that way. Like, if there was another one, I don't remember them. So, you know, that's when you become sort of more conscious of being Jewish is different than being Christian, but it was never bad. It's not like there was ever anti-Semitism, and not that there would have been, you know, it just meant that, like, when it was Hanukkah, like, my mom came and did a Hanukkah presentation for whatever class I was in. And that meant that everybody got a plastic dreidel to take home and everybody got a bag of chocolate Hanukkah gelt.
While his Jewishness was perhaps unique in his community, thankfully, he was never made to feel particularly different because of it.
I don't think about it as an otherness, because it's not like there's, you know, prayer in public school, right? It's not like everybody else was, like, kneeling at the start of the day and you didn't. So, no, I don't think I felt, you know, it was a difference, right? Like, just like we lived in one part of Sugar Mill and other people lived in other parts of Sugar Mill and other people lived in Covington Woods, or, you know, my dad drove a sports car, the guy next door drove a pickup truck. There's a lot of differences that, you know, make children who they are. But yes, we were different because we were Jewish. And even more to the point, we were Jews who kept kosher. So if you were a friend that was visiting my house, it was like, I'll get your silverware, I'll get your plate, because it can only go on this kind of plate. And don't worry about, like, I'm not going to explain, like, Leviticus and the rules surrounding all of that to you. Like, just accept that that ice cream can only go in this bowl and you can only eat it with this kind of spoon, and you can't eat it in the other bowl with the other kind of spoon, because that's just what the rules are.
Perhaps the most unique thing about Eric among his elementary school peers was the connection he felt to the city of Houston. Sugar Land in the early 80s wasn't quite as diverse as it is today, nor was Houston quite as sprawling then as it is now. Nevertheless, Eric did still feel connected to the city even then.
I felt like we were more a part of Houston because we would go in a lot, right? Both of my parents worked, like, my mother worked downtown, my father worked in the medical center. Our synagogue is in Meyerland. So we would go back and forth quite a bit, but I think for my friends, or for most of my peers, there wasn't as much direct contact with going into Houston, right? Like, going to Houston was something special. Going to Houston for us was, like, pretty normal.
For the most part, Eric and his younger sisters, Adrian and Deb, got along well and had a pretty simple childhood, at least through his elementary school days.
So middle school is when things, you know, middle school was farther away, but still close enough to ride a bike to, but a much bigger school with a much more diverse population. Not that I was involved in it, but, like, fights in the hallways, you know, fights after school, all of that stuff was part of it. And maybe, like, the first time that I struggled a little bit academically, like, I was a very good student in elementary school, like, always more all 6 weeks than not. And I guess the first time that sort of changed was in sixth grade, where there were maybe more B's than A's. So I spent a year in a public middle school, and then in seventh grade, I transferred to a private school, St. John's.
Ironically, considering what he now does for a living, Eric's strengths in school were always more academic than artistic.
I guess, like, in elementary school, it's funny, I wasn't a great writer, but, you know, math and science, you know, science for every year, good at the sort of basic arithmetic, like, fast at remembering multiplication tables and all that kind of stuff. I always had a head for that. Oral presentations, that stuff was always a strength. I'm not very coordinated. I'm not very, like, I can't draw. Like, art was never good for me. I mean, history was always something I was really interested in. And I read a lot of, you know, history books and biographies of great Americans and all that kind of stuff. So, and that continued. When I moved from public school to private school, still science, less math, and very end up, like, all of my history courses. It's funny, I had an interest in journalism, maybe not that you would call it that, but there was, like, you know, the middle school newspaper, the high school newspaper, but I was never on staff of any of those things. You know, that was always, like, because I wasn't, like, a great English student, and I couldn't tell you now, like, what it was about my writing that was deemed deficient. I mean, you know, all the grammar stuff and the, I couldn't tell you, you know, I don't remember it clearly enough, but I always loved reading. I read a lot of books, you know, didn't always turn them into book reports afterwards, but I was reading constantly. Like I said, biographies and history, and then eventually like kind of junky science fiction fantasy and good science fiction fantasy. I mean, I tore through like, you know, The Hitchhiker's Guide and the Dune series and like a pretty decent stream of current events too. I mean, you know, we subscribed to Time magazine. I, you know, as I got older, I started reading that pretty regularly. I read a lot. Reading was a pretty normal pastime for me.
He also played sports a bit as a kid, although he was never much of an athlete.
You know, I played pretty mediocre, like dad pitch baseball. I played a little bit of soccer, but like I just didn't run fast, not super coordinated, like just not a good athlete. I know it's a cliche. It's like the same kid was always picked last every time. It is not a cliche. That was literally my life. And it gets to the point where like the coach or whatever the adult is in charge is like, okay, I'm going to make Eric captain. So it's like, okay, so now I get the first pick. And then the kid who was picked right before me is last, you know, just for a change of pace.
Unlike a lot of kids, Eric was always, from an early age, very interested in trying new foods.
I was always a pretty adventurous eater with some sort of bright line exceptions. But I have like a very clear memory of going to the Pappas Seafood that doesn't exist anymore on the Southwest Freeway with like my whole family. Like my memory is that my grandparents were visiting from New York and we all went to the seafood restaurant and there were frog's legs on the menu and I had never had frog's legs. And so that's what I wanted to try. I didn't know what they tasted like. I didn't know what they were going to look like, but like I wanted to try the frog's legs. And, you know, and we ate pretty well growing up. Like Jews and Chinese food is a stereotype, but in my family's case, that stereotype is true, right? I know plenty of Jews who didn't grow up eating a lot of American-style Chinese food, but we certainly did weekly, every other week, like General Tso's chicken and beef with broccoli and all that stuff, egg rolls and dumplings. That was all a huge part of our childhood. And then my parents liked to go out to nice restaurants, and they would usually go by themselves, but occasionally, like, they would take us along. So, like, my mother celebrated her 40th birthday at Brennan's, and you know, my father celebrated his 40th birthday at the Rotisserie for Beef and Bird. And then especially once we were both going to the same school in River Oaks, like there were more meals in town because it was sort of tied to various school activities. So, you know, I remember going to Ruggles Grill growing up or the River Oaks Grill or Damien's was a big one for us. Like we spent, you know, a lot of family occasions. So, you know, we were eating at these kind of nice restaurants that like didn't have a lot of children in them, but as long as we behaved ourselves and, you know, could find something on the menu, that was all fine. And I remember being like 8 or 9 and we went to Anthony's, which was one of Tony Vallone's restaurants at the time. And that's the first place I had tiramisu. But you know, what's funny is that there's like a whole range of foods that I wouldn't encounter until college. Like, even though I grew up in Houston, like I didn't eat sushi for the first time until I was in college. I didn't eat crawfish for the first time until I was in college, you know, and now I think that's almost impossible, right? Like kids encounter this stuff so much earlier than I ever did. But yeah, that started early, like trying new things started early and it stayed with me. I liked sort of places in our neighborhood. We had a Chinese restaurant that I really liked. We used to spend a lot of time at the Black Eyed Pea and we had to drive like from Sugar Land all the way to Missouri City to get to it. So that's like a 20 plus minute schlep to the Black Eyed Pea. But chicken fried steak, right? Like that was always a favorite thing. Somewhere around there, a lasagna house opened up like on Westheimer at Eldridge. And like, again, like that wasn't super close, but it was close enough. You know what I mean? So we went there quite a bit. You know, I mentioned Anthony's and I did celebrate my 10th birthday, I guess 5th grade at Anthony's in like my little, you know, sport coat. And my parents let me take two of my friends from elementary school. And I think that was, talk about when you know you're different. I had been going to these restaurants. So like, it was my favorite place. I wanted a special occasion. I think it's probably pretty safe to say my two friends had not been going to those places with their families. And so maybe like, that's one of those where it's like, there are things about my growing up that are different than the way other people are growing up.
Those differences became increasingly apparent socially as he and his classmates transitioned into the upper school at St. John's.
I don't know that there were sort of major moments in high school. For whatever reason, like my year was like very socially, like there were just a lot of cliques and there was like a hierarchy and I was at the bottom. And it wasn't even like a good or a bad thing. It was just like, those were who my friend, like, you know, I was a nerd and my friends were nerds and we fooled around with computers and, you know, like that was kind of, you know, who we were. Computer games, online bulletin boards, you know, message boards, And they had their own games that were sort of connected to like turn-based strategy games, I guess, for lack of a better word, you know, because it's not the internet. It's like you're literally dialing into another computer. So only one, or, you know, if it was really sophisticated, two people could be connected at the same time. So I had a couple of friends who were really into that world and who kind of introduced me to it. And that was something that I spent a decent amount of time on.
Eric graduated from St. John's in 1996 and was accepted to several schools, but matriculated at Colby College, a small private school in rural Maine.
Maine has always been a thing for my family. My father's parents started going there on vacation when he was a teenager. And so not every summer, like maybe every 3 or 4 summers, we would go up to Maine with my grandmother for a week. And so I had a connection to that part of the world. My grandmother lived in Providence. So Providence to Maine is, to the border is probably a couple hours, and to where we were going was maybe 3 or 4 hours. So that was always a thing. And like I said, so basically I started in sort of central Pennsylvania and went north. And based on the choices that I had at the time, Colby was the most appealing because St. John's was a grind. It was a lot of work. It was very demanding. It was very high pressure. And I'm certainly better for having been through that experience, but I had the sense of wanting more balance. And Colby felt like a place where the expectations and the work would be challenging, but you could let your hair down a little bit too.
Letting his hair down as an 18-year-old away from home for the first time meant drinking alcohol, and plenty of it.
I drank way too much as a freshman. I discovered really quickly that when I drink too much, I get sick to my stomach. And that's sort of fun when you're 18, and it gets progressively less fun the older you get. And it's why, like, I like cocktails, I like spirits, I like beer, I like wine. I like all of those things now. I rarely ever like really tie one on because I pay such a steep price for it pretty quickly. But like, I've never been a drug guy. You know, like I tried pot a couple of times and I was like, this makes me hungry and talkative. And I do that naturally. I don't need drugs for this. And I just never got into anything more adventurous.
Beyond just partying a bit, Eric began to really sort of find himself at Colby.
So I was a history major in college. They started a Jewish studies program when I was a sophomore, I think. So I picked up a minor in Jewish studies. Like I said, I think I sort of came into my own as a person in college. Like I think maybe in high school, like one of the things is I took myself, I don't know if I was shy or just awkward, you know, like they're not, it's not really the same thing, but I certainly wasn't very confident. I don't know. College was more liberating. I felt more like I knew what I was doing, I guess, or I was a little more comfortable. And so I dabbled in some theater. I did a little writing for the newspaper. I had a radio show. I started to get really into music, like not making it, but just like listening to it. So more like in the high fidelity sense, right? Like a curator. I wanted to listen to all the cool stuff, all the new stuff. And so I had a 2-hour radio show that I'm sure had like 3 listeners. But it made me really happy because it got me into contact with a whole bunch of bands that I probably wouldn't have encountered otherwise if they weren't, you know, the CMJ stuff that was lined in the shelves of the radio station. And Colby was pretty isolated, but it was an hour and a half to Portland. So if you wanted to go see a show in Portland, like that was a possibility. And like maybe once a semester, like down in Boston to see like a bigger band.
Music wasn't the only reason Eric and his friends would travel though. He found a community of friends at Colby who shared his love for good food.
There were a couple other people who liked dining. So like we would drive to Augusta, which was about a half an hour away, to go out for Thai food. And then like once a semester, we would pile in the car and go down to Portland and have sushi, right? Like, so there were 3 different dining halls, pretty impressive for a small college, I suppose. And they all had different menus and we all had favorite dishes. So why do I remember this? Why do I remember that when Foss Dining Hall had pot roast with real mashed potatoes instead of the usual instant crap that they served, like that's where I was dining that night. You know, that kind of taste of home and that kind of care in using like semi-decent ingredients, like that was the plan for the night for me, you know, back then.
As much as Eric enjoyed his life at Colby College, it didn't prove to be the most sustainable way to get an education.
I didn't graduate from Colby. How do I explain what happened to me? I was a good student. I understood the material and I could participate in the discussions. I was a poor student in the sense that I did not like producing the work and I wasn't very organized. So those like big end of semester research papers, I was not good at producing them. You know, you get an extension, but eventually like the extension runs out and I still would not have written the paper. So I would get like a D. So I would have like two A's and two D's. And after 2 years of that, they were like, you need to like go away and think about whether this is for you. And I spent like a year back home in Houston, took a couple classes at U of H, had a little more success because the requirements weren't quite as steep. Went back to Colby for a couple more years, came up short again, and that was kind of it. Like, I didn't wind up graduating. So I'm sure I must have been the world's most frustrating students for most of my professors. So, because like 100, 200 level classes, no problem, right? You know, if there were a couple of 5-page papers, no problem. Assign me the 20-page paper that you have to like spend all semester like doing the research and creating an outline and pulling it together. I couldn't do it, and I didn't know how to ask for the help that I needed to get there. I guess I just didn't have anyone like holding my hand. Like, it's not that kind of environment. I think in a different academic environment or at a different kind of school, maybe there would have been someone to be like, this week, like, you need to produce this thing and you need to show it to me. And if you haven't showed it to me, like, I'm going to take your car keys away or whatever it was. Like, that might have worked. But I didn't have that, and it certainly wasn't their requirement to provide that for me. It's just looking back on it, it's like, I don't know what would have made me do it the way that I was supposed to do it, but I certainly didn't do it. And eventually I flunked out of college.
Having parents who were both in like professional fields, did that create tension for you guys?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. And it was a disappointment. I mean, that was the one time, I guess, when it seemed like I might have finally started to figure it out. But by the time I went back, like all of my friends were gone and it was just very lonely and I was too old to be there, right? Like, it's sort of one thing to be 21, 22, but when you're like 23, 24 in that environment and like, it's not like U of H, right? Where there's like all these veterans or people who have come to college like as adults, everybody's like 18 to 21 and being that like 2 years older makes you old. And it was just very isolating, and I washed out, and that was the end of that. And by then, I was kind of done with school. I mean, I had, you know, this is kind of that late 90s, early 2000s tech boom, and I had become friendly with a lot of people in Houston who were a part of that, who were working and making, like, pretty good money without college degrees, like, in a startup kind of environment. And again, like, I wasn't a programmer. I wasn't that technical, but I just had like an interest in it. But I was kind of ready to work. So I had always done kind of office jobs, internship kind of stuff, summers. And I just started working kind of in the legal field, document processing, litigation support is probably what it's called. This is really like not glamorous work. Like, there's pride in doing the job well and delivering a good product for your end customer. I don't know that there's a lot of people who are proud to be like data analysts for litigation support companies. I don't know. Maybe there are. I wasn't one of them.
You weren't working for an attorney specifically?
No, I wasn't working for an attorney specifically. I was working for firms that would outsource the, like, in litigation, there's just terabytes of documents. And it all has to be entered into databases and categorized. And so I was like one of those people who was like, you know, this is kind of the beginning of digital processing. So all of the paper would get scanned and turned into images. And then those documents would be read and basic information, who wrote it, when they wrote it, subject line, that kind of stuff, was entered into a database to be searched by paralegals and attorneys to be used as evidence in depositions and eventually, you know, became the basis of settlement negotiations, I guess. So I was the guy reading the documents, entering the information about them, and I was pretty good at it. Like, I was fast.
And how long did you do that?
For a surprisingly long amount of time and through a series of temp jobs and eventually into like a supervisory position with a litigation support startup. So roughly like 2004 or five until roughly 2011. And one of those jobs was in the third floor sub-basement of the Shell building downtown, which is no longer the Shell building downtown because Shell has moved all their operations to West Houston. But so not just Not just like a kind of soul-sucking office job, but a soul-sucking office job four stories underground.
At some point, the company Eric was working for fell on hard times and had to lay most of their staff, including Eric, off. He spent some time looking for another job in the same field, but his lack of a college degree made things difficult. So at 33, he made the decision to finally finish college.
My transcript was such that like UH like wouldn't admit me. It was pretty dilapidated at that point. But UH downtown did, and so I started going to UH downtown. I basically walked into a counselor's office, and they were like, what do you want to do? And I was like, what gets me out of here as quickly as possible? And they said, interdisciplinary studies. So I said, okay, and just tell me what I have to take to get out of here as quickly as possible. I will say UHD gave me a ton of credit for previous work, like going all the way back to my AP exams from high school. And so that made it really easy. And then like some of the basic stuff that like I hadn't covered in college or whatever, like you could take a CLEP test for. And I CLEPed out of probably three or four classes. Somehow like I didn't get credit for freshman comp, you know, like whatever you want to call it, English 101. I did not have a credit for that. And I was going to have to take that. And the CLEP test saved me.
Eric wound up graduating from UHD in December of 2012. But unfortunately, his dad, Carl, didn't get to see him finish. He passed away earlier that same year.
He got cancer for the first time when I was in sixth or seventh grade.
What sort of cancer?
He had throat cancer. Ironically, he started smoking in medical school, which does not seem like a very good decision. And then they found, you know, a lump in his throat and he quit smoking. The details were shouldered from us. We were pretty young, but, you know, I don't know if the smoking is what caused the cancer, but it probably didn't help. So he came through that and he basically got another 20 years. So in, I don't remember if it was 2009 or 10, they found a new kind of cancer where I don't remember. Again, like head, torso, neck, somewhere in that kind of, man, the details that at the time I could have told you everything about it. But it was serious and it was bad and it was pretty virulent. And he fought it as best as he could for 2 years. It stayed pretty normal for maybe the first year. And then the decline happened really fast. And then he just couldn't fight it anymore. And that was it.
How did you handle that?
Well, I had started writing by then. So my first job writing was with Eater. And that started in May of 2012. And he passed away in July. So I took a few days off and then I just went back to work because I didn't really know what to do, you know? And he always worked so hard and I just felt like he wouldn't have wanted me to stop working, right? Like, so I went back to work. And I will say, like, being back in school and not working at the time, like, that meant that, like, I could take the burden off my mother every now and then and I could take him to some of the appointments at MD Anderson and participate in the family in that sense. And so that was good, you know, but he was happy that I was back in school and I had taken the LSAT. It looked like I was on the path to law school. And so if nothing else, like, you know, even though he never got to see me graduate, like, you know, at least I was finally on the path towards a degree, which was always super important to both of my parents.
As you mentioned, Eric's first job as a writer was with Eater Houston, and it began in May of 2012. But the journey that led him there had begun several years earlier.
So in 2007 or 8, I guess, like I said, always been into food, always been into restaurants, always been into trying new restaurants. And so this is the time I was in my late 20s and early 30s, and there was just food activity in Houston, right? This is the beginnings of the modern Houston food scene, for lack of a better way of thinking about it. And, you know, we were going to places like Beavers, to Catalan. And a good friend of mine was like really into, like had started a food blog. And so it was kind of connected to the world in that sense. And, you know, maybe I think he had gone to a pop-up, one of Randy Rucker's pop-ups. Randy had had a restaurant called Laidback Manor that I had never actually eaten at, but then he was at Rainbow Lodge and eventually opening a restaurant called Bootsy's in Tomball that had a run as a really interesting spot. And anyway, and so all of this was sort of going on, but I guess it was through him that I found out about pop-ups, right? Because I was reading his blog and reading other local food blogs and Rob Walsh restaurant reviews and Allison Cook restaurant reviews, and all of that was just kind of out there. And so I think we, you know, went to a pop-up, one of Randy Rucker's pop-ups in his house. And we were talking to a guy who had a food blog who was like, oh, well, you sound like this is something you're real interested in. You should be part of the Houston Chow Hounds. That was like a mailing list, like a Yahoo group of people who traded messages about restaurants and dining and experiences. And that led me to my first meal at Himalaya and then like a taco truck crawl. Like, you know, everybody meet at the Caninos Market. We started there and then we went down to Long Point and hit a whole bunch of stops on Long Point. And that day wound up being really significant, like that taco truck crawl in like 2009. That's where I met Chris Reed and Michael Fulmer, the two guys who founded the Houston Barbecue Festival. Catherine Chilcutt, who would go on to become the food critic for the Houston Press. And like that peer group, it was like, you know, these are my people. Like, this is who I'm supposed to be hanging out with. And so like, I was just like a guy with a day job that was like into food, but I started, everybody was on Twitter, right? So I got my Twitter account and I was following all these people and interacting with them and going to things and getting to know the chefs. And then like in 2010-11, you know, like Chris Shepherd left Catalan to start working on Underbelly and Jonathan Jones left Beavers and started doing something else. And like, you know, Bobby Hugel was working on opening Anvil. And so there would just be like pop-ups, like it, you know, Grand Prize had opened by then. And so there'd be like all these cool chef pop-ups and food trucks are happening. And so I was like starting to meet people, learn about this stuff. And like, I was like my food blogger buddy, Misha Goffstein. I was Misha's friend, right? And I would just go to this stuff and I would be Misha's friend. And I would, you know, I was like connected to that world, but I wasn't a player in it. I was just like someone who appreciated it. But so in the spring of 2012, the woman who started Eater Houston announced that she was leaving. And my friends, Misha and some of the other people, knew that I had an interest in this stuff, had read my posts on, you know, the Houston Chow Hounds, and there was a thing for the Houston Press where me and a couple other people were burger judges, and I'd written about the various burgers that we had tried and what we did and didn't like about them. So they'd read a little bit of my writing about food, and they knew that I was like unemployed, right? Like I was going to school, but I didn't have a job. They were like, you should do this. You would be good at this. And so I applied, and I guess I put together some test blogs, and I had been reading Eater, of course, and I, you know, I was reading the Houston Press and the Chronicle and Culture Map and everything else, but I'm not sure that I understood like what made Eater's coverage different than somebody else's coverage. You know what I mean? But I put together some test blogs. I took some feedback. I think they just decided that like, I knew what I was talking about. My grammar and sentence structure were pretty solid. And oh, by the way, they were only paying people $1,500 a month. So, you know, you have to be like in a pretty special place in your life where like that's enough money to commit to writing every day, 5 days a week, multiple stories a day. And if I had bombed out, like they would have just fired me and found somebody else. So looking back on it, I didn't come into it with this much intention, but looking back on it, three big questions, right? Like, could I find something to write about every day, you know, and hit deadlines and all of that kind of stuff? Would I enjoy it? And then would anybody read it? And if any of the answers to those questions had been no, then I was working on my degree. I had taken an LSAT prep course. I took the LSAT. I was headed to law school. Like I really thought I was headed to law school. And if you had asked me now 7 years ago, right, I was like, I don't know. I just started this LSAT prep course. I'm finally fulfilling my destiny as like a St. John's student and the son of an attorney and someone who worked in the legal field for a long time. And I'm finally going to law school and I'm going to be a lawyer. And I never would have thought that I would be a writer. But, you know, it turns out that finding something to write about every day was not a problem. There's always something happening. And people seem to like reading it. So this is what I get to do.
Eric's time at Eater Houston lasted about 14 months, but really it was broken up into a couple of different phases.
The first 6 months, I was still going to school. And so like eventually I structured my classes in a way that made it easier to write, to work and go to school. But it was hard to like be fully committed to it. But at the same time, like I was meeting people and getting story ideas and even breaking a little bit of news, right? Just because I'd be talking to people, like I'd be Justin Burrow, who now owns Bad News Bar, was working at Fitzgerald's. And every Tuesday was, were they $5 cocktails? Were they $7 cocktails? Whatever it was an industry hang. He would make good cocktails, but in a plastic cup and at Fitzgerald's, which is, you know, not like the nicest place in the world. But they were cheap. I mean, that was part of the fun of it, was that they were cheap. And so there were always industry people at that Tuesday night cocktail pop-up, and I started to meet people. And that was one of the things, is that my predecessor at Eater, you know, was a wife and a mom and like had responsibilities beyond writing or beyond her job. Well, I didn't have a spouse and I didn't have kids. I had two dogs who maybe took it on the chin because I was going out a lot, but I was determined to just like go out and meet people. And that was like one of the early pieces of advice that I got, was like, this whole industry is based on personal relationships. So like, go out and meet people. And so I just went out a lot and met people and, you know, went to the pop-ups and broadened my relationships and started to immerse myself in that world. So like I said, so the first 6 months were kind of treading water. And then once I didn't have the responsibility of school anymore, I had my degree, I was all set. I could really throw myself in the job. And so like they gave us quarterly traffic goals. Like this is how many people we think should be reading the site every month. So they gave me a quarterly goal for January, February, March. And I don't remember what I was doing exactly. I couldn't tell you like what stories were breaking in early 2013, but whatever it was, I had hit that goal by the end of February. And so all of March was like bonus traffic. And then they gave me an even higher goal for April, May, June, and I exceeded that too. So somewhere in the middle of all that, the writer who had been covering food for Culture Map left. And I was referred to them and they were referred to me and we started talking. I really liked Eater. Eater's changed a lot since then. At the time, it really suited my personality. It really suited, you know, quick reported, easy stuff, was like aggregated stuff that traded on my ability to sort of read things and compile them and spit them back out. It was like suited me really well. But, you know, like I said, I started at $1,500 a month. So I asked Culture Map for $40,000 in health insurance. And they said yes. And that was it. I mean, Eater was not going to match that. So I started working with Culture Map. And it's going to sound like I'm sucking up, but it's been great. I was reading everybody. So I didn't have a lot of perspective on like how much bigger the Culture Map audience was than the Eater audience. Because Eater's just, not that it's a small audience, but it's pretty niche. And the Eater editor is relatively anonymous, and Culture Map like was built on personalities, right? So when I started, it was, you know, Shelby Hodge doing social and Clifford Pugh doing fashion and Joel Luke's doing arts. And they were like, okay, Eric Sandler, you're the food guy. You're going to be our food expert. And so, you know, there was a lot of marketing of me as a personality, and it's only grown from there. And this is such a silly thing, but I remember my mother had gone to a meeting at her synagogue and someone said something to her about, oh, we've been reading your son on Culture Map. Well, that never happened at Eater. That was never a thing. And so that was when I first started to feel like this was breaking through a little bit.
And he was right. Eric turns out 8 to 10 articles per week for Culture Map, including a wildly popular monthly column dedicated to highlighting the best new restaurants around town. The platform provided by Culture Map has led to other important opportunities in Eric's career as well. For example, he also co-hosts a monthly segment on the fantastic and wide-reaching local radio show from Houston Public Media, Houston Matters. He's also had a weekly podcast of his own since April of 2017 entitled What's Eric Eating, in which he keeps listeners informed on literally everything happening in the Houston food scene. I honestly don't know how, in the midst of all his creative output, he finds the time to experience all these restaurants. But he does.
I eat out a lot. I was thinking about it. I have been to like 5 new-to-me restaurants in the last 8 days. And part of it is that monthly column, that Where to Eat column, it precedes my involvement with Culture Map, and it is such a staple of the site, and it is something that people refer back to. You know, like I was standing in the valet stand at Riel not that long ago, and this couple looks at me, and the guy goes, "Excuse me, you're Eric Sandler?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Man, we're here because I read your article about this place." I was like, "That's awesome." And then his girlfriend like looks at me and goes, "Oh yeah, you make him look good." And that's awesome. You know, I think that's so much fun. And that people like plan their meals based on that list every month is a huge compliment. So that drives me to get out. And it's why I was just at Taste of Nigeria. And it's why I will be down at Hyde Park in Clear Lake in another week or two, because that column needs at least 8 new restaurants every month to be relevant. And it's better when it's 10 or 11. And so, and again, like I still live by myself with my two dogs. So cooking for one is a drag and I just have to go out. And now the nice thing is, the nice thing is about the podcast is that, you know, we have that restaurant of the week segment and I have a co-host that sits in with me. And so, you know, at least I get to drag someone else with me. It's like, all right, come on. We need a restaurant of the week to talk about. So get in the car. We're going to Clear Lake, or get in the car. We're going to the Woodlands, or get in the car. We're going to whatever.
As demanding as his job is and as busy as it keeps him, Eric doesn't take for granted the gift that it is to get to do something he loves for a living.
I was someone who read people like me for years. And it never occurred to me that I would be one of the people who gets to do what I do. And I just feel really lucky to get to do this, because I just never thought, even now, you know, almost 7 years into writing full time, and it is definitely my profession. Like when I'm feeling really highfalutin about myself, I call it journalism. I'm a full-time food writer with like a pretty good salary and health insurance, and I'm not a blogger, and I'm not, you know, I'm not a social media influencer. Like this is how I pay my bills every month. Like I open up my laptop and I jokingly call it, I make words for the internet. Like that's what I do. And even though it's been a long time, like I still feel really lucky to get to do this. So that's awesome that you describe me as an institution, and there have been so many small steps along the way that have helped me get there. It's still kind of amazing to me that like I'm one of those people. But every morning at 9 o'clock, it's like that conversation with my editor. It's like, what do you have today? Still got to find something to write about every day. You know, that part of it hasn't changed. It's just more of it comes to me now, right? People want coverage in Culture Map, and I've built enough relationships with people that like more of it comes to me now. I don't have to hustle quite as hard to get it.
Tell me what you love about what you do.
So, like I said, I love that moment when someone says, I read you all the time and we had a great experience at this restaurant that you recommended. And I love being able to get behind people that are doing good work and shine a light on them and get people to them. So the one that sticks out clearest, and it's been a few years, but Wesley Jarena, the pitmaster of Papa Charlie's, like he had a trailer that was set up at then Jackson's Watering Hole, which was a bar in my neighborhood. And he was making like pretty good barbecue, but he was never very busy. And, you know, I met Wes and I was talking to Wes, and it was pretty clear that he was getting to a decision point about whether he was going to get to continue doing this or not. And I interviewed him and I wrote it up, and it was right at the start of football season, which was a big deal for that bar because it brought a pretty big crowd in. And so the combination of the football season crowd that went there and the attention from my article about how good his barbecue was the difference between him like giving up and him like getting enough of a following to eventually open his own restaurant, like to get off the truck and open his own restaurant. So there's not necessarily like a ton of those stories, but knowing that in a small way, the work doesn't change people's lives necessarily, but if you're doing good work and you're in a position to where you're ready for it, the right article at the right time can really make a difference for people. For people who like deserve to achieve success. And that's really gratifying.
I assumed Eric probably loved his job. I mean, who wouldn't? In my mind, it was about getting to spend all your time eating out at the best restaurants in town, probably typically for free, and being recognized as a tastemaker in a major city. But that's not it. Eric loves what he does because it enables him to shine a light on others in the city. He uses his platform as a means to point his audience, whether they be readers, listeners, strangers, or friends, in the most honest way to the places he loves most and the people who are working hardest in Houston's thriving culinary scene. After spending years ghostwriting content week in and week out for the social media channels of artists and organizations who were far more concerned with growing their virtual audiences than actually adding value to their lives, I can't tell you how refreshing it is to find someone who chooses to use the platform they've been given exclusively to serve the city in which they live. Eric Sandler is doing that for the city of Houston, and I, for one, am thankful for it. Huge thanks to Eric for all that he does and for being a part of this episode, and to all of you for continuing to support this show by listening, rating, and reviewing The H on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you believe in the art of storytelling and want to hear deleted scenes and bonus content from this and other Milieu Media Group podcasts, you can partner with me for as little as $1 a month at the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The H Podcast. Thanks so much for listening, friends. We'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 6. This episode of The H was produced, edited, and mixed by me, Luke Brauner. Our artwork was designed by the fine folks of Field of Study in the Heights. Check them out at fieldofstudy.design. Our theme song is by Robbie C., and other songs featured in this episode are by Houston-raised piano prodigy Cameron Pissera and local instrumental artist, Broer. This and every episode of The H is brought to you in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on marketing, branding, and making the world a better place to live. Check them out at pinkcilantro.com. And now, here's a scene from our next episode.
At 15, I ran away from home. I had a friend in Texas, and I came to Texas. I still went to school, though. I forged, I signed papers for me to finish, to go to high school and finish it. But yeah, I've been in Texas ever since. I ran away from Cali and brought myself all the way to Texas.